Tonight, we're going to talk about the cryptic code of the Templars in America. It's an amazing story. Scott Wolter back with us. He was last on the program 10 years ago with my colleague Ian Punnett. It's a long time, but since then, he's done a lot. He's done a program which is going to be rebooted, a television show on the Travel Channel called America Unearthed. He's got a whole slew of books with the latest coming out in June, The Cryptic Code of the Templars in America. And we'll be back and talk with Scott about all these incredible things next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our geologist. Scott Wolter has been a president of the American Petrographic Services since 1990, responsible for the independent petrographic analysis testing where the Kensington Rune Stone was brought for investigation in 2000. This was uncovered by a farmer. It's an amazing story all by itself. He has looked at 5,000 various investigations throughout the U.S. and around the world, including evaluation of fire-damaged concrete at the Pentagon following the attacks of the 9/11-2001 tragedy. Scott, welcome back to the program. Can't believe you were on 10 years ago.
George, when you said that, I couldn't believe it. And, hey, how is Ian doing?
Ian's fine. He had tinnitus. He has moved to Arizona, but he's back filling in for us once in a while. But he's holding up. Okay, he's got a PhD now.
Oh, big shot.
Yeah, he's a Dr. Punnett now.
Well, please greet him next time you talk to him. And I have to say, 10 years ago, he attended one of my lectures secretly before I was on the air. That he came to one of my talks, and he asked a question about something on the runestone, and it turns out he was absolutely right. And one of these days, I'd like to talk to him about that because he's a pretty sharp guy.
PhD, he sure is.
Turns out, well-deserved.
He sure is. And you've been busy. Now they're going to reboot your television show, America Unearthed, I hear.
That's right. That's right. In fact, tonight, it's now Tuesday. Tonight, it premieres. We have 10 episodes. And after a four-year layoff, it's hard to believe we've been resurrected.
Excellent. It's on my mother's birthday, Scotty.
Well, happy birthday to her.
She turned 90 today.
Oh, that's great.
So she's gonna pop on the show on the Tuesday night program and give everybody a little bit of words of wisdom.
And you have to sing for her.
I did that for her a couple of weeks ago in Columbus, Ohio, as a matter of fact.
Good for you.
Well, good. Well, I want to talk more about the TV show, but let's talk about the new work that's coming out in June, The Cryptic Code of the Templars. Tell us about this.
Well, you know what? You know, that runestone, you mentioned it, has been an enigma for 120 years now.
Jeez.
And I think I've finally gotten to the bottom of that well. And I know that some people are saying, oh, sure, there's got to be more. Well, you know, I became a Freemason about 4 years ago. And one of the things that happened to me, I was going through a degree in the York Rite, and all of a sudden, something happened in the degree that was directly connected to the runestone. And I know that sounds crazy, but it's 100% true. And it helped me understand that a large part of the inscription is allegory and parts of it are real historical truth. And that's exactly what our Masonic degrees are, a combination of those two things. The hard part is figuring out which is which. And when it comes to the runestone, I think I've found that last piece. It's an amazing document that just keeps on giving.
It sure does. Now, explain what a rune is for us, Scott.
Okay. A rune is a symbol that is, for the most part, made up of straight lines. And these were first developed in Scandinavia. I don't know exactly where, but somewhere probably in Norway. And we've seen them starting in about the 4th century carved in wood, but primarily carved in stone. And the reason it really lends itself to carving in stone is because it's mostly straight lines. And this is the alphabet that the Vikings used, and it was used all through Scandinavia right up until the 1800s in some places in Scandinavia.
Well, in this particular case, the Kensington runestone, discovered by a Minnesota farmer in 1898, he was clearing trees from his field, right?
That's correct.
And he uprooted this large stone carved with these mysterious runes, and it details a very interesting journey back to 1300s.
That's right. The stone is dated 1362, and it's mostly carved in runes. You're correct. However, there are three Latin letters, AVM. There are numbers, several numbers on the runestone, and they happen to be something called pentadic numbers, which are Arabic in origin, which begs the question, what is a Muslim numbering system doing on a supposed Scandinavian runestone?
Good point. Good point. And, you know, if this is the case, they got here way before Christopher Columbus got here.
Oh, you mean, I call him Chris, you know, that guy that didn't set foot on the continent, that already had millions of people living here, that guy?
Yeah, that guy. The guy we celebrate every once in a while, right?
Well, you know what? That's slowly changing. And, you know, nothing against Columbus, but he was in many ways a political pawn as well. But I think that is changing. I mean, we know that the Vikings were here around the year 1000. And then, you know, the historical narrative wants us to believe that from 1000 until 1492, which is almost 500 years, that nothing happened, nothing at all. I have a hard time with that one.
I had a guest, God rest his soul, Glenn Kimball, who used to talk about Egyptian hieroglyphs found near the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
If that's true, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells you what I already know deep in my heart, is that there have been cultures coming to North America and going to all continents for a long, long time. And you know, did the Egyptians make it here? I don't see any reason why not. The copper culture goes back probably 5, 6, maybe even 8 thousand years ago, coming to the UP of Michigan and Lake Superior and just picking copper up off the ground, which back in those days was more valuable than gold and silver. So they've been coming here for a long time.
Remember when we were in school, they talked to us about a little boat called Kon-Tiki?
I do, with Thor Heyerdahl.
Yep, exactly. And he got here crossing the oceans, I guess.
Well, if he could do it, you know, in modern times, why couldn't they have done it in the past? And, you know, he made an amazing boat. But back in those days, I'm sure they knew how to make those boats even better than he did. So he proved it, and I'm sure it happened many, many times.
When I was introducing you, what is a petrographic service? What is that?
Okay, well, petrography is the science that we perform in our laboratory, and basically it's the microscopic examination of concrete and rock. And basically what I do, George, is I perform autopsies on concrete and rock. So whenever there's a problem of any kind, if it has low strength, it cracks, the top comes off, or fire damage, as was the case at the Pentagon after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
It will take samples, send them to us, and we'll do our examinations.
When you looked at the Pentagon concrete, what did that tell you?
Well, that was an amazing case for a lot of reasons. But first and foremost, I got a call from a representative with the military, our government, and they said, you've been assigned to the Pentagon, which was really bizarre because most of the time I'm out there trying to hustle work, right?
And, right.
And to get assigned to something that was so big and so important was obviously a big deal for us. And I know you remember, like everybody listening remembers, what an awful day that was and how frustrating and angry we were. And, you know, everybody wanted to do something. And so for us to have an opportunity to actually do something and help was an honor and a privilege. But basically what we did was we looked at all the heat damage caused by the jet fuel fire of the steel-reinforced concrete columns and beams. And the original plan was to do a surgical-type repair to tell them if this column could stay, this one could be repaired, or it had to be torn out. And it turned into the fire damage was so severe, the temperatures were so hot, that they decided, you know, based on our results, they just tore it out along the construction joints and started over.
There was some controversy during that time period, of course, about the entire episode. But some say that it was not a plane that hit the Pentagon, but a missile.
Correct.
Did your analysis convince you one way or another what happened?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And for years, it's been a while now since I've had calls, but I used to get calls from people that would say they were members of the, they would often say members of the Patriot community that were talking about, you know, different theories about what happened there. And I can tell you 100% that it was a 757 that hit that plane. There were a lot of people who lost family members, people that lost mm-hmm. members of the crew. I saw, you know, what happened there, and there's no question that a plane hit the Pentagon. Now, what happened at the Twin Towers that day, I can't tell you. I wasn't there. I thought the what appeared to be a controlled demolition of Building 7 was very suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I can't say what happened there, but I definitely know what happened at the Pentagon.
What a time. What a horrible time. And we're still mired in that.
Well, it changed the world forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I can remember my father was an airline pilot for Northwest Airlines. And when I was a teenager, I can remember getting on airplanes flying to the west, out to Montana. And hunters would get on with loaded shotguns and put them in the overhead bins. I swear to God, that's true. Can you imagine today?
Oh, my God, you couldn't do it.
No way.
You could not.
So the world has changed, and I'm not sure if it's for the better, but I think it's they were necessary changes.
How did you go from being basically a forensic geologist into the things you're covering now?
Well, it started with the runestone, George. I mean, it was that artifact that really, you know,
that did it.
Kicked this off. And, you know, when I started this work, I never heard of the runestone. I didn't know about the controversy. I knew nothing. I thought it was an interesting story, but, you know, as you know, I get involved in some pretty crazy things. And so I did this work, and I thought, well, you know, when it was over, I did a tombstone study. I compared the weathering with the runestone, and I concluded it was hundreds of years old, and it was genuine. And I thought to myself, well, they got one, good for them. I wrote my report, and I thought that'd be the end of it. Well, turned out it was just the beginning, because I got calls from people who, you know, had some pretty serious questions and sharp criticism. And I'm not afraid to answer questions. I mean, I thought to myself, if I made a mistake, I'll fix it. But that's not what it was about. They didn't like the answer. And, you know, at first I was confused, and then I got pissed. And that's what drove me to get to the bottom of this thing. And here we are now, 18 years later.
Are you in Dayton, Ohio, or Minneapolis right now?
Right now I'm in I'll tell you where I'm at. It's in Chanhassen, outside of Minneapolis, about 20 miles, and I live a mile and a half from Paisley Park, where Prince used to live.
Uh-huh. I sure did. Dayton just got hit with a pretty bad tornado.
Well, you know, the weather's been crazy this year. Unfortunately, we've dodged a bullet. We've had lots of rain, but no serious storms yet.
So were you in Minneapolis 10 years ago? Because Ian was living out that way.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I told you, he came to one of my lectures.
Yeah, that's how then. Okay.
Privately. There was a guy sitting in the back who was asking really good questions, and I kind of wondered who he was. And I remembered his voice, and then, of course, when I went on his show, I put two and two together.
He was doing his homework.
He was doing his homework, exactly.
Good for him. I will tell him that you asked about him and get you two together again.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Now, the book, The Cryptic Code of the Templars. Tell us about the Templars, because they seemed during that era, Scott, to have been everywhere, touching everything. They were the watchdogs of the Shroud of Turin. Who knows what else they were doing?
Well, that's right. You know, they are a fascinating group. And, you know, my gosh, I take myself back to 2000 and to think I would, you know, become an expert on this amazing military monastic order is just mind-boggling to think about sometimes. But yeah, they were everywhere. And I don't think people fully appreciate and understand you know, how amazing they were. And it really started with a group of monks called the Cistercians. And they were they were formed back around 1100. And they had one abbey at Citeaux in France. But in 1113, a very charismatic name by a guy by the name of Bernard de Clairvaux joined the order with 30 family members, which included two members of those original nine knights that went into the Holy Land in about 1109 and dug under the Temple Mount and found some amazing things. And the world forever changed after that. But during Bernard's lifetime, that order exploded. And by the year 1300, there were over 750 abbeys all across Europe, into the Holy Land, into Scandinavia. And, of course, it was Bernard who wrote the charter for the Knights Templar Order when they were first founded. And many people don't realize that. And they became immensely wealthy. They had a huge sailing fleet going all around the world trafficking goods. And they became immensely powerful to the point where the King of France and the Roman Catholic Church eventually figured out that if they didn't do something, they were going to take over. So this is part of the history that people really don't understand. And it was the Cistercians who were on the island of Gotland, which is a part of Sweden, in the 14th century, and most of the language, runes, and dialect features on the Kensington runestone we found on the island of Gotland. And the only clergy that was there capable of carving an inscription of that complexity and length could only have been the clergy, and the only clergy on Gotland were the Cistercians. So that's how we got to the Templars and connecting it with the runestone.
Aren't the Templars also named in the Oak Island money pit that they possibly could have dumped some stuff there?
Well, is it possible? Yes. However, in my personal opinion, I think that if the brothers have done anything, they have proven that whatever might have been there was either moved or recovered.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if they're going to find anything there. But, you know, the one thing, too, that people need to understand about the Templars, they would never put all their eggs in one basket. They may have put some treasure on Oak Island, but they wouldn't have put all of it. Nobody that's thinking straight would do something like that.
What has been the strangest thing you've investigated?
Oh, my gosh. The strangest thing? Well, in episode 2, you will see me investigate a couple of different caches of artifacts in Mexico that have absolutely no question depictions of aliens.
Oh, I
and
love this
I never
stuff.
Thought I would ever investigate the question of aliens, not because I don't believe it. It's just because it was never in my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, George, I ask people to be open-minded about the things that, you know, I feel strongly about. Turnabout's fair play. And I have to say, you're going to be shocked when you watch that episode. And that's all I'm going to tell you.
All right. Well, we're going to come back and talk more about the TV show America Unearthed, because there's some amazing things that you've investigated, of course. And I want you to talk about the Jack the Ripper case, because maybe you have found another suspect as well. Stick with us. Scott Wolter with us. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And his new book, which comes out in just a few weeks, The Cryptic Code of the Templars in America, Origins of the Hooked X Symbol. We'll have him explain that too when we come back. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take calls next hour with Scott Wolter as we talk about his latest work, The Cryptic Code of the Templars in America. That book comes out very soon. And also his reboot of his television show, America Unearthed, which is on tonight, as a matter of fact, on the Travel Channel. Why did it stop, Scott?
Well, George, that's a great question. And what happened was we had just finished season three, and ratings were great. At the time, we were the number one show on H2, and we were gearing up for season four, and they sold the channel. H2 was sold to Viceland, and they put us on hold. And then they asked me to help out on another TV show called Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. It was a six-episode series, so I did that for a few months. And then when I came back, they said, my agent said, they're not going to renew you. And I said, oh, well, that's too bad. Why not? And he said, and I swear to God this is true, he said, because your show is too smart for history.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not really sure what that means, but you know something? I feel that there are a lot of people out there that are hungry to learn. And, you know, I really don't want to dumb down the show. I want to keep it the way it was. I think we make it understandable. I think we make it fun. I think we make it interesting. And I think that's something that people like. I mean, there's plenty of things that people can watch to sort of escape, but I also think that there's a time when people want to really learn new things. So that's what we try to do.
Well, let's hope it's got a long life to it this time.
Well, we'll see what happens, but I will say that History Channel treated me very well, and I appreciate, you know, that opportunity that we had there. But Travel Channel has been a different experience. It's been really, really good, and I think you're going to see some good things.
Super. Now, tell me a little bit about this investigation into the Jack the Ripper suspect.
Well, that was a really, really fun episode to make. I was contacted by a father and son team of physicians who live on Long Island, who actually were investigating the wounds. As doctors, as physicians, they were curious about the wounds of the Ripper victims. And because of that, they came on to a suspect who is a very well-known person, a name that you will recognize. And they approached me and said, hey, we think this person might be involved in these murders. Now, when they started to describe the suspect and the wounds, something resonated with me. And all I will say at this moment is that it had to do with my becoming a Freemason. This person
really?
Is also a Freemason. And all I can say is you're going to be surprised at who this person is. But I think that you will find that we make a very compelling case, and I think we may have unmasked the Ripper.
That's interesting indeed.
Yeah.
What was his name?
I can't tell you yet.
Okay.
For the show, I love you, man, but I can't do it.
Okay. there was one story that came out years ago that he could have been a dentist who ended up back in St. Louis, Missouri. Francis Tumbletree or something like that.
Well, you know something? One thing that that these two guys, again, they were doctors. They are doctors. That they said is that the person that did this had to have been a physician, somebody who knew their way around the human body. And based on what I've learned during the making of that episode, I think they're right.
Yeah. It was precision cuts when he did his thing.
Yep. Absolutely, and removed body parts.
Yeah.
So not everybody could do that in the middle of the night with blood and subduing a victim and do it in less than 10 minutes.
Now tell me about this cave in Pennsylvania. What's that?
Well, that was a tip from a person who had contacted us back when we did the show 4 years ago, and we were going to take a look at this cave back then. Chris Courtney was a 12-year-old boy at the time who was playing in his backyard, and he was chasing after a salamander, and it disappeared into a hole, in his backyard. And he, when he pulled the stone out, he found a cave. And it turns out that this cave has a very interesting and rich history that probably was used over a period of about 250 years for various things. And that episode leads me to meet some very interesting people, including people involved in the, that study the Underground Railroad back at that time. And oh my gosh, you're really going to like that episode. And it gets pretty intense and pretty emotional at one point.
I find caves to be creepy, Scott.
Well, you know what? I find them fascinating. They can be creepy for sure. And, you know, you have to be a certain type of personality to want to go into these things down into the ground. Some of them go for miles. And, you never know when you go into those caves, and you never know what might be in those caves that's alive or dead.
Why is there so much symbolism with the Templars and the Freemasons? I mean, they all seem to have symbols in these things. How come?
Well, you know, symbols are their own unique language. And, you know, first of all, they're ancient, of course, and the symbols that are used within Freemasonry and going back through the Knights Templar are part of a tradition that go back thousands of years, I believe, and I would even go so far as to say all the way back to the Atlanteans, who I personally don't think Atlantis was a place. I think it was a culture. I think it was a worldwide culture of a high intelligence, and I think that symbolism and those symbols go back to that time period, but it was a way to communicate. And it was a universal thing that I think many cultures shared. And it's also a way to communicate secretly with people that are initiated and have learned the meaning of certain symbols while others don't. Symbolism and symbols is a vast subject. It's fascinating. And I've learned a lot about symbols and symbolism since I became a Freemason. And it's amazing.
What is the hooked X symbol that you talk about in your latest book?
Well, the hooked X symbol is really, it was the key symbol on the Kensington runestone that led me on the path down to the Templars and beyond. And in the book, I this symbol was the symbol that Ian Punnett asked me about in that lecture earlier on. And what he said was, Scott, do you think that symbol could somehow be related to the Hebrew Aleph, the first letter in the Hebrew alphabet? And you know what? He was right. It absolutely is related to that. And it's an ancient symbol that goes back to the Hebrew language. The Templars used it as one of those secret symbols that meant many things. And in this new book that I publish, I think I have found the origin of this symbol. It was carved in a place on a bone box. And, George, if you had said to me, Scott, if you could find this thing anywhere in the world at any time, pick the place, I never would have picked this. I would have said it's too good to be true, but yet, There it was.
Earlier, you talked a little bit about these extraterrestrial artifacts that could be, and I know it's on an upcoming program, so you can't say too much, but is it mind-boggling stuff?
I don't even know if there's a word. Is there a word that goes beyond mind-boggling?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. Absolutely, it's mind-boggling, and you know, and some of the things that are depicted on these artifacts are mind-boggling. But at the same time, there's an intelligence to it. There are things that suggest many of the things that people have speculated about when it comes to aliens. And I don't want to portray myself as some kind of an expert, because really I'm just getting started in this whole field. But many of the things that I've heard people talk about, if they're not depicted directly on these artifacts, you could interpret some of the things depicted as being those things. It's I'm really just still sorting it out. And you talk about symbols. These things are covered in symbols. And I don't know if they're a language. I don't know if it's a form of telepathic communication. I really don't know. But I will say this. It's time to take them seriously.
Do the ETs look like those ET grays with the big heads and the big eyes?
In some cases, yeah, they do. They look exactly like that. In other cases, you see the elongated skulls with mm-hmm. the almond-shaped eyes. You often see depictions of interactions with what appear to be Mesoamerican indigenous people. And you can clearly tell the difference. Yeah. Yeah.
Has this changed your views of ET life?
Well, I would say that my views have definitely evolved. I will say this. I have not reached a final conclusion yet. There's a lot more work to be done from my perspective. But for a subject matter that I didn't really pay any attention to a few years ago, I'm paying attention now.
You do. It makes you wake up, doesn't it?
Well, it makes you sort of rethink the way you think the world works. I'll tell you what it's done, George. It's made me appreciate more than I already did. And I thought I appreciated looking up into the sky more than most people, because, you know, people nowadays are so captivated by their phones. They're looking down all the time, whereas I don't think anybody can argue cultures in the past looked up, and it appears now it wasn't just to look at the sun, the moon, the stars, Venus, the constellations. Maybe there was something else up there that they were looking at.
I was watching a Netflix series over the weekend. It's called What If, and I look for television production values and stuff like that. That's what I'm interested in.
Right.
And I got to tell you, almost every other scene, and this was a pretty good show, but almost every other scene, they had a smartphone in it where they would show somebody's text message coming on to one of the other actors.
Right.
And it's amazing how they're using that technology in these films and movies.
Well, we do it in our show.
Yeah.
It's the thing. It's our way of life now. It's unavoidable. And, you know, people identify with that. I mean, it's like, you know, I can't sit here and pick up a telephone and start dialing, right? I mean, I have to use an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way it is. We have to accept it. The world has changed, and we have to change with it.
Vikings in the desert. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know what? The title of the episode is almost an oxymoron. I mean, what would the Vikings be doing in the desert? Well, this was another tip that came in, you know, at the end of season 3, 4 years ago, and we were going to look into it at the time. Now, unfortunately, the original person that gave us the tip passed away about a year and a half ago, and his son is carrying the torch for his father, and he's on the show and brings forth these artifacts. All I can tell you is that I was skeptical going into this episode, but I've learned that just when I think something isn't what it purports to be, I'm surprised. And I was very surprised at what happens with these artifacts, and it leads us on an amazing journey, and I really think people are going to enjoy the episode. I sure did making it.
Scott, do you go into most of these episodes skeptical?
Well, I'm not sure if skeptical is the right word. In some cases, absolutely. In some cases, I'm familiar with the subject matter. It might even be something that I've pitched that I want to do, so you know, I'm not going to be skeptical. I'm going to be excited about investigating it and see what happens. And in some cases, you know, I really don't have any opinion at all. I just go in with an open mind. And you have to remember something. You know, the Templars coming to America and, you know, carving the runestone, building the Newport Tower, and a lot of the things that I ask people to be open-minded about, I have to remember that it works both ways, right? So, you know, things like aliens or Bigfoot, which were never things that I really had much interest in, I need to remember that I have to be open-minded as well. So that's what I try to do.
What do you think of, like, the Georgia Guidestones and things like that?
Well, you know what? I had a fantastic time with those stones. And, you know, if you've ever gone there and read the so-called tenets that are on there, most of the things are on there, just about everything that's on there, you can't really argue with or have a problem with. They're reasonable things that, you know, advice for humanity. Of course, the one thing that gets everybody excited and upset in many cases is the suggestion that there should only be 500 million people on the planet. Now, personally, I was always a big population guy when I grew up.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to do something about that population. Otherwise, we're going to have a problem. I mean, history has shown that when populations get out of control, it doesn't end well. And, you know, I think we're on that path, quite frankly. And I think education is the answer, because it's a fact that the higher education women have globally, the fewer number of children that they have. And I know I had two kids, and I don't know how people do it that have more, especially in the fast-paced world that we live in today. I don't know what's going to happen, but it can't keep going the way it is, or we're asking for trouble, in my opinion.
Scott, when we come back, we're going to take an hour of phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.